Chapter 5. From the first time she saw him, fresh off the Montana coach, bewildered and out of place in her salon, Louisa had been afraid of him. Everything about him frightened her. His height, his blue eyes, his big nose, his strong hands, his awkwardness, his vulnerability, his ideas, his masculinity. The spirit that she saw play in him as bright and dangerous as lightning in a heavy sky. He was completely strange to her, completely different from her. She shared nothing with him. His reality was a denial of hers. To touch him would be to destroy him, or to be destroyed. So extreme a reaction displeased her. She sought control over herself, both mind and body. Coolness, courage, self-possession were her own ideals. Itali's presence was a severe test of these qualities, but to avoid him, which would have been the simplest and most natural thing in the world, to send him off and not see him again, would also be cowardice, admission of defeat. She had invited him back against Enrique's feeble protest. Heleska and Estenska had both taken him up. And now the whole group of radical journalists were people of some note in the city. She would have had to meet him in society anyhow, unless to escape him she'd gone over the widening gap and joined the Viennese, the conservative and pro-imperial salon. She kept in touch with that portion of society by accepting the very minor position at court which had been her mother's. She was called to the palace once a week or once a fortnight, while the Grand Duchess was in town. She enjoyed the contrast of the sad, stuffy, shabby court formalities with her own increasingly brilliant and animated circle. She enjoyed testing her own nerve and her power on these ambitious and argumentative men. For most of them, she had a good deal of contempt, which she concealed most of the time. Towards Itali, no degree of self-control and self-mockery could dispel the attraction she felt, or the fear of that attraction, and the resentment of it, and the terror and pleasure of his presence, which challenged all she was and all she thought she wanted. She had grown up, not in Krasnoy, for the most part, but on the immense family property in the Sovena province, which her grandfather had accumulated. The parents mostly stayed in Krasnoy, for the court connection was the important thing in Baroness Parodeska's life. The children were left in the country in the care of nursemaids and servants, until, when he was 11, Enrique was sent off to a military school for noblemen's sons, where he was unspeakably unhappy, and Louisa, at 8, was left alone among the servants. She had done pretty much as she pleased in those years of her childhood, in the big, bleak house, isolated on a knoll amidst the flat, fertile, wind-swept fields of her inheritance. Her playmates were the children of the estate overseer and of the tenant farmers, one step above the peasants, having had a year or two of schooling, shy, dark children, hard as nails, slaves to the Baronina's whim, until, goaded too far, one of them would turn on her and call her a papist, their worst insult, and spit in her face, fight her, and often beat her. She could not get on with any of the girls. It led always to a fight. Her companions were boys, whom she could lead in exploits that lack of imagination or doer sense would have forbidden them. But they did not like being dominated either, and when she was 10, she crept home with a broken wrist. She had teased the smith's son, Cass, into a rage, and he cracked her arm across his knee as he would crack a willow stick. When her mother arrived for her annual visit a week later, the story was that the Baronina had had a fall from her horse. "She's very wild, ma'am," the nurse said, weakly sounding an alarm. The Baroness gave orders that Louisa should stay in to study 6 hours a day with her tutor, the house priest, and should not be allowed to play with Protestant children. And these orders were more or less obeyed until the end of the month, when the Baroness left. And Louisa was off to find Cass before the carriage was out of sight on the long road across the windy plains. A year later, she and Cass took to playing a game which they called the Wild Dancing. Father André's history lessons had included some confused accounts of heathen superstitions and rituals and Roman methods of divination. They could find out everything that was going to happen in the future, Louisa told Cass, if they danced the right way and killed a hen and read the messages inside her. They stole and killed a hen from the farmyard. Louisa was scared by the awful simplicity of the head twist. She never liked to watch that. But the boy was excited by her fear and disgust, by theft, waste, gratuitous killing. He tore the bird open with his hands, plunged his hands into the entrails, and pushed her face into the bloody mess, jeering, "Read it! Read it!" She had fought down screams and vomit and said, I see it. I see the future. I see fire, fire, a house on fire. He danced for her, naked, on the threshing floor, in a dark autumn evening of fog and fine rain. They were alone among the long, dreary fields. His thin, white child's body flashed before her, dancing, strong, wet with mist and sweat. She had not danced for him. After that night, they had scarcely spoken to each other again. When she was 13, she began the relationship that finally got her sent back to Krasnoy. She had always been savagely rude and arrogant to the overseer's eldest son, jeering at him and inciting the other boys to bedevil his life. Now she suddenly made a friend of him, and very shortly the overgrown, overmothered boy of 16 had achieved great power over her, cowing and fascinating her with his causeless rages, caresses, intimate talk, fits of laughter, fits of tears, and threats of suicide. He told her how he had seduced a peasant girl, describing every word and act vividly, and how they'd met again and again, and all they'd done. Louisa listened, and at last, envious, jealous, a little incredulous, tried to match his stories, using her imagination freely. She told him that Cass had slept with her hundreds of times. The boy believed her, approached her, and began a fumbling attempt to undress her. She took her clothes off and stood still. He made her lie down and lay on her, but he was impotent. She began to hit at him, scratch at his face when he would not let her go, and she got away from him and scrambled into her shift and dress. The next day, he talked her into trying again, and the same thing happened. The boy went home and tried to shoot himself with his father's hunting piece. His mother came into the room as he was in the act, and he shot her instead and blew her right hand off at the wrist. some connection with Louisa was made out from his blubberings and wild talk. It was all kept quiet. Baron Parodesca, then dying of cancer, never heard of it. And Louisa came back to Krasnoy to a convent school. Now, after 10 years, all her Slovena childhood seemed infinitely far away. Another person than herself in another world. Yet sometimes she remembered the overseer's son and his soft, struggling, impotent body. Or remote, the brief vision of a boy dancing naked in dusk and rain. She did not like touching. The kisses women were expected to exchange, handshakes. She did not permit her maid to dress her or to brush her hair. When Itali first came to her in April, in the room she had taken in a hotel near Westgate, she had been in unconcealable terror, trembling and stiff, silent, her eyes dry and wide. Yet she had been there, waiting for him, like an animal that has walked into a trap. Nothing could have set her free but the intensity and impersonality of his desire. His passion submerged her fear like a wave over a sandcastle, and all the fear turned to equal passion, all the sand to the water of life, for a night. Sometimes, some nights, for a while, since then. When her mother's illness became severe, she was not able to come at all. During June and July, she did not see Itali alone, and only twice briefly in company. Her time was given entirely to the dying woman. She nursed her through a 9 weeks' agony, patient and competent. Her mother died, clinging to her hand. After the funeral, she stayed home, seeing no one, for a week, and then had taken up her usual life, insofar as the customs of mourning permitted. But she made no sign to Itali. He would not be turned away now, and she gave in to him. For the first time, he made love to her in her own house. With some caution regarding Enrique and the servants, that had become their usual arrangement, her maid letting him in very late at night. Often she put off a planned meeting, or made obstacles to setting a night. Often, when he did come, she was at first passive and cold in manner. Never until the night at the Hilescas had he told her he could not come. She waited for him a night in mid-September. He was late. He was at the Illyrica, or at the office of his journal, or with Karante, or with Estenska, or some or any of the others, the other men in their world, his world, the political world. She looked about at her world with an ironical eye. The high-ceilinged, blue and white-painted bedroom. Yet she had been right that night about the journal. "Will the censor let you print anything now?" she had asked. And they had not listened, going off in high spirits and good fellowship to write up the events of the great day. The Bureau of Censorship had returned the proofs to them 3 days later, with all reports on the Assembly's first session deleted. It was the day the journal went to press. All they could do was take out the type and run the first 3 pages through entirely blank, except for the heading Novesma Verba and the date. On the same day, the third day of debate in the Assembly, the President announced that the decision to use the vernacular had not received the Grand Duchess's sanction and was thus invalidated. Aragon at once raised the question of the Grand Duchess's power of sanction and veto. Since the Articles of the Assembly declared it to be subject only to the King, and there was no King. Since then, debate had struggled on. The left trying to put the question of sovereign authority, and the right interrupting mainly with demands from the chair that the deputies speak in Latin. Italy and the others had written up a cautious report of these sessions. The censor stamped it out, and the journal appeared that week with one column on its news page, a hastily composed patriotic effusion by Caronte, and the rest of the sheet dead blank. The only news the public got of events in the Assembly room was the brief summary of motions and votes on an inner page of the Courier Mercury. Prime Minister Cornelius saw no need for violence, which was abhorrent to the system. It was merely a matter of laying one's trump card down quietly at the last moment, game after game. And it was a game that he, as surely as his idealistic opponents, had staked his life on. Only he had the soldiers and the empire on his side, which made the contest somewhat uneven. She saw that. She did not think Itali, or Estenska, or even Haleska saw it clearly. She did not say much about it, but she continued to fulfill her duties at court, and she entertained men who could help Enrique in his modest diplomatic ambitions whenever he asked her to, or when she saw the opportunity herself. She saw no disloyalty in this. Why should she be loyal to a cause from which she was excluded? How could she be? She could not play the game. Therefore, she did not care who won it. Still, he did not come. It was past 2. She had been sitting at her dressing table. She lay down with the magazine he had bought her, the Bellerophon, a monthly which took most of the literary stuffing out of Novesma Verba, which had become frankly political and philosophical. In this issue, Itali had a long review of a dictionary and historical grammar of the Orsinian language and its dialects by a professor at Soriari, the leading article. Apparently, they were all excited by the dictionary and grammar. Patriotism. She tried to read it. Itali's written style was terse, logical, and didactic. Effective, but not seductive. Not for reading lying down. Luisa yawned and began skipping. Estenska had contributed the second part of a long review of Caronte's novel. There weren't even enough of them to quarrel healthily. They all had to praise one another. It was small, their world. It was shabby, as mediocre as the dreary court of the Grand Duchess, as futile. They were not free, though they talked forever about freedom. Nobody was free. "There's a nice picture," said Itali's quiet voice. She'd gone to sleep. She opened her eyes, struggling for consciousness, but did not move. She knew from his voice that he was smiling. "Fell asleep over my review, did you?" he said, bending over her, so that she smelt the night air on him and felt the warmth of his mouth brush her cheek. "Novel reader." "You can read dictionaries if you like them," she said, opening her eyes, and then shutting them again to stretch a long, supple stretch and yawn. "Don't ask me to. I don't trust words." "You're very late." "I know. I'm sorry." He took off his coat and stock and sat down on the bed in waistcoat and shirt sleeves. His face looked grave and shadowed in the light of the single candle. She watched him, studied his face, as she always did, as if by watching him she could find out what he was. "At the Illyrica," she said. "Talk and talk and talk, words and words and words." "No, I was with a friend from that school I taught at for a while. He's out of work." "You're all out of work, always." She knew he did not like to be teased about the erratic jobs he had taken to pay for his rent and bread, until Novesma Verba, thriving, could pay him a tiny salary. She knew the subject of his relative poverty as one of the most dangerous ones that lay between them. It was precisely because it was dangerous that she began to edge near the crater. But no temper stirred in him now. He merely nodded and said, "Egan quit his job. He had a good one, tutoring a family, some grain merchant in the Trasfuive. He's consumptive, and a doctor told him that living with the children, he put them at risk. So he moved out. They tried to make him stay. I don't know what to do for him. If he could just have a year or so to get his health back." Itali put his head in his hands. "I don't know. I don't see how he can get free at all, but it can't." "Yes, it can. It probably will. It generally does. And there's nothing you can do about it." "Why do you torment yourself?" "I don't. He's my friend."
"You do.
None of your friends is worthy of you. They're all doomed, defeated in advance."
"Estenska?" he said with a kind of laugh.
"Estenska most of all. He is in love with defeat." "I don't want to talk about all that now," he said impatiently. "I'm tired." He turned to her, but she swung off the bed with a lazy, evasive motion, gathering her silk dressing gown about her, went to the dressing table, sat down before the glass, and began to brush her hair. He lay back across the bed, his arms over his head. "Don't forget to wind the clock and say your prayers," Louisa said. "What have I done wrong now?" he asked in a dry tone, but good-humouredly enough. "Marriage is not what I want."
"I know that. Do you?"
There was a pause before Itali answered. "Louisa, there has to be a certain amount we take for granted, an area of trust between us, or we can't get on at all. We can't start over every time."
"Yes, we can. That is precisely what I want, what we should do. Nothing taken for granted. Nothing settled, expectable, cut and dried. Each night, the first night.
But there's no use, so long as you come to it from... Where do you come from?"
"What do you mean, where I come from?"
"All the men you waste your breath on. All the second-rate people. The people you don't belong with. Let the weak lean on one another. You cannot share pain. That's the worst hypocrisy of all, the most degrading. Charity, humility, the vile Christian virtues. What are you doing in that cage?" Her voice was light and mild. She continued to brush her hair with a long, rhythmic stroke. "You come to me from a cage and never know you've left it, and run back to it in the morning." He sat up on the bed and sat for a while, gazing off into the shadowed end of the room, where long white drapes hid the windows.
"I come to you for what no one else ever gave me, ever offered me. It is trust, the greatest trust. I don't know how to handle it. I'm no good at it. I know I hurt you. All I can do is offer you what you give me. That trust, that care, that cage."
He had stood up as he spoke, and she rose, turning to him, meeting him in the centre of the room, her hair loose and her body warm and fresh in the flowered robe. The sleeves dropped back from her arms as she put them up to embrace him.
"I want to fly beside you,
like falcons, like eagles over the mountains, never looking down, never looking back.
I love you, he whispered,
gathering her against him. A much more expert lover now than he'd been in the garden at Aesna, but no less tender, responsive to her response, so that although she wanted to go on talking, wanted to tell him, I am your freedom, and what I see in you is freedom. She said nothing, feeling the words dissolve, and the barriers go down, and the joy she feared so deeply pick her up and sweep her off like foam on the torrents of the thaw. He lay asleep beside her when she roused in early dawn. She lighted a candle. He did not stir. Again she studied his face, warm and heavy in sleep, undefended. To lie together all night naked, that was trust, yes. But she did not like the word, if there was only a way to get free of words altogether. But the servants would be getting up. He liked to leave while it was still dark. He had been bitterly resentful of the humiliation he had felt once, when he slept in her bed till 10, and had to be spirited out by her and her maid in a comic opera scene that she would have found very funny, if only he had found it funny. He was so naive and so provincial still. The disapproving schoolboy, the humorless Robespierre, the bumpkin pedant, self-righteous. So the fear, hastily reinstating its rights and boundaries within her, rebuilding the barriers, denied gratitude, denied the yearning, brooding warmth of her body against his, her face watching his, and made her wake him sharply, saying his name. He started up, then lay back with some inarticulate word. Wake up. Wake up. I am, he said, turning his face against her shoulder. What a nose you have, she murmured, sinking back for a moment into the warmth. Like a ship's prow, ever onward. He was asleep again. I don't want to go, he groaned, and sleepily began kissing her throat and breast. She tensed, slipped away and out of the bed, and put the flowered gown about her, turning her back on him. I'll tell Agata to watch the back stairs for you. Louisa, wait. She half turned, impatient. He sat up, scratching his head. I meant to talk about this last night, but it was late, and we... He pushed back his hair and looked at her through the dim sphere of the candlelight. His face still had the heavy, defenseless look in it, the innocence of sleep, the lip slightly swollen. I may be out of town for a while. Where? How long? She responded without emotion. Amade has asked me to go home with him. I'd like to do that, and then go on to Rakava, and do a series of articles on the situation there, or find a correspondent there who can do it for us. A few weeks in all, I suppose. She did not like the sensation of her long, heavy, fair hair loose and tangled on her head and over her shoulders. She had not braided it last night, because they'd had to make love. She went to the dressing table and brushed her hair back from her face with harsh, practiced strokes. When did Amade finally make up his mind? He asked me to come with him a couple of days ago. Well, he's been on the brink of going back to the Polana ever since I met him 5 years ago. He won't stay long. If Itali went there, there would be a month, 2 months, that she could sleep alone, that her mind would not have to go through all the miseries of jealousy, anxiety, resentment,
and terror that her body or her soul or some blind, stupid omnipotence forced upon her. She would be free. "Don't stay too long," she said. "I won't." "No fear," he said, with naive gratitude. He got up and began dressing. In the mirror, she watched him put on his shirt and button it. Then his collar and stock, the stately mysteries of male clothes, the waistcoat, the tailed coat. "I'll be back by mid-November at the latest," he said. He had obviously been afraid she would object to his going, and was relieved that she did not. "Perhaps I'll go to Vienna with Enrique while you're gone," she said. "He'll never get up the energy to go by himself, and he's got to meet the ambassador if he's ever going to get any sort of position. Though I suppose if I went, I'd have to stay through Christmas." "Oh, what a bore. I don't know." "Why don't you come to Vienna? It would broaden your mind a good deal more than Estenkens' sheep farm and dirty Rakava. We'll stay at the König von Ungarn, just behind the Dom. Do, Itali." Sitting on the bed to put on his shoes, he looked up to meet her mocking, challenging glance over her shoulder. "Oh, God, you are so beautiful, even at 5 in the morning, he said, muffled, bending down, then standing up again. "I can't go to Vienna. Someday." A little sheepishly, but also ready to take offense if she went too far. For it was a question of money, of course. It was always a question of money. She nodded politely, dismissively, and went to put a garter on the alert. Most of the servants were reliable. She knew exactly whose servants they exchanged news with, and did not care what they said. But Enrique had hired a footman away from Count Raskineska recently, and she did not want to be discussed by that lot. Raskineska was exactly the sort of man who got his gossip from his servants, and then used it maliciously. "Pierre's still asleep, ma'am," Agata murmured. She looked back into the room and said to Itali, "All clear." He came up to her in the doorway, dressed, armoured in the whole cloth of this age of respectability, formidable, a stranger. She shivered barefoot in her thin silk gown. "I don't want to go," he said softly, not touching her. "I don't want to go now. I don't want to go to Rakava." He leaned down, kissed her very lightly on the lips, and went out. She did not even hear his step on the stairs. She went back to bed and curled up in the place under the covers that was still warm. "Now I can sleep. Now I'm alone," she thought. But instead of sleeping, she began to cry, hiding her face under the sheet, grinding her fists into her eyes like a child.